production of the Public Affairs and Special Events Department of KLRB News.
This is Dialogue Assassination with political research specialist Mae Brussel and guest today, Bob Cutler, East Coast assassination researcher. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
And Mae, again, welcome back.
Thank you. Let's get
right into things. What's the, like we usually do, try and explain briefly what Dialogue Assassination is about?
No, you hit
me with it last week.
I hit you with it last week. You want me to do it this week?
Yes.
The Dialogue Assassination is a program that tries to keep interest regenerated or renewed or strong into the political assassination in the United States. I believe that the assassination of Senator John Kennedy, Senator Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King were conspiracies, and I believe they're not big issues. We go on there every week, take the news of the week, current guests that our researchers visit us, and we show how the news of this week is affected by the past political assassinations. And we have a guest from the East Coast from Massachusetts. I've referred to his book and his work on the East Coast. We've been corresponding for a long time, and Mr. Cutler, Bob Cutler, is here today to talk about his research at the other end of the country over in Massachusetts. It's a long way away, but we see a lot of things in common, don't we?
That's an awful lot to have to cover, I have to say so.
Yes, there's a lot of ground there. Well, we talked, I promised this week that we would get into the Chappaquiddick affair because it's current with the elections coming up. A lot of talk of Ted Kennedy in the news. Briefly, let's just mention this book again that you did, Two Flight Paths, because I've talked about this, and I have not talked about it on the air on a whole program, but I have mentioned it. You have a book called Two Flight Paths, Evidence of Conspiracy. Do you want to explain what the flight paths are that you're writing about there?
I think I can do that. The first flight path is the path of the bullet that was supposed to have gone through the president's neck, through the governor's chest, through the governor's wrist. Part of it was lodged in his left thigh, and it was found about 45 minutes later, 3 miles away, on a stretcher in the hospital.
This is Governor John Connally.
That's Governor John Connally, now
yes.
Secretary of the Treasury,
yes.
As you all know. This bullet became rather famous, and its name now is CE-399, which is merely Commission Exhibit 399. It was accepted as evidence during one of the commission hearings. And as a result of that, it became necessary to make this bullet the cardinal issue, let's say, of the Warren Report, the very basis of the Warren Report, because without that one bullet going through two people in the motorcade, the president and Governor Connally, it was impossible to allow or permit or even think of the lone assassin theory. This is the real reason why we talk about Commission Exhibit 399.
Because, I think we should explain that Oswald's rifle couldn't do. There was a time span that with which he could get a certain amount of bullets out.
Exactly.
And
couldn't fire it that fast.
He couldn't fire. And the movies.
Nobody could, as a matter of fact, let alone Oswald.
Yeah, but in the movies, they reconstructed the time period from when the president was first shot until he was killed. And it was impossible to get out more than three bullets, if that many, in that particular time period.
6.8.
So if there were more than three bullets anywhere, then Oswald was not the lone assassin, and there was a conspiracy.
That's right.
So
one bullet had to do many more things than is possible to do for one bullet.
That's right.
But isn't the argument that Oswald was the lone assassin, isn't the argument substantiated by the fact that they say he was an expert and that he could have fired them that quickly? The argument has already been brought forth that somebody could have fired that quickly, and you're saying that it
you could have, but there was no hit time. There was no aim time. That's what I mean. In other words, it takes a little bit of time to aim in between. The only way that anybody could actually get three shots out in 6.8 seconds was to just merely work the rifle and the trigger, work the bolt and the trigger, bam, bam, bam. No aim at all, no thinking about it, just doing it mechanically.
And even besides the flight path, the impossibility of doing all the bullets said, there was no proof, and this is another subject, that Oswald even owned a rifle.
That's very true.
Or that it ever came to him. So therefore, right. The reconstructing of bullet 399 becomes very important on how the commission reevaluates their evidence to make the story fit.
Oh, yes, it certainly did. This is called the single bullet theory. And the interesting part, if you take it from the standpoint of one who, you know, I'm used to drawings, because being in the architectural business, that's what you're used to. So if you say, if you can put the limousine on the street in the right place, and you can put Oswald in the window, supposedly in the assassin's nest, you should be able to draw a line from that window through the president and then through Governor Connally, because it's very clear in the report that the bullet was not deflected by anything in the president's neck. It did not hit any bone. That's a whole other story. Yeah. And the two things do not work. It doesn't work in plan. It doesn't work in elevation. The angles are incorrect. The two men were not lined up so that this could happen. And as a result, the whole single bullet theory becomes a figment of the imagination. It's our inspector's imagination, very active.
It's a good thing to write a book on just one subject, the bullet. That you've done. I'm going to do one book on just evidence destroyed, physical evidence
yes.
that was destroyed in restructuring this particular crime that they had to do in order to say Oswald committed
right.
the murder. And if you understand evidence destroyed, then it pertains to like the ITT memo where they pulverize everything in the office. This is why the current news of this week is if you understand the past, you understand the present. When they want Mrs. Beard's office, it helps to understand when you can go in and take everything and shred it and pulverize
right.
it. And then, again, this morning's news, they produced a memo that was the authentic one, but it was written by some other woman and not Mrs. Beard. And I put this under delayed evidence. If you understand the John Kennedy material, like the bullet, like you've done, any piece right. of evidence, you can understand what's happening. The news becomes very easy to read. Because
right.
people know something is wrong. We know specifically what is wrong and how they handle evidence.
Right.
Now, this book, your address is 38 Union Street, Manchester, Massachusetts. If you care to get this book, Two Flight Paths, this is the address, Cutler Designs, 38 Union Street, Manchester, Massachusetts, 01944. It's $7. That is not an unfair price for all the research that people think, you know, that these books are expensive today. They're worth every cent. I know everybody who has bought the books I've recommended, we're glad to have them and bought more.
Could I say just one thing about the second flight path, because it is important.
Oh.
As you're looking into the single bullet theory and trying to find out what happened to CE-399, it became evident that if you could take and look backwards through the governor's chest and extend a flight path backwards towards where the actual bullet that went through the governor actually came from, and that is the second flight path. If you do that, you have to set the governor just in the right position and put him in the limousine on Elm Street and then look backwards through his chest, and what happens is that you come out in plan and in elevation. That means in the vertical angle and in the horizontal angle. You come out on the sixth floor of the TSPD, the Texas School Book Depository Building, but you do not come out at the window where the Warren Commission says there was a rifle. You come out at a window much further west, about eight or nine windows further down along, away from the tree that blocked the path of the CE-99 until such and such a frame. In other words, the two flight paths are evidence of conspiracy in that one of them is an absolute fake, is a negative, other is a positive.
And also, along those lines, there was a German Mauser in the building, and the first weapon found was a German Mauser for 24
and
hours.
And attested to.
Yes, and that...
By Weizmann.
And Oswald mentioned seeing that rifle in the building. He was angry. That's one of the things that he spoke about.
That's
the German Mauser was found in the repository, and all the law enforcement agencies said it was a German Mauser. Holding this gun. Mark Lane's written that up at length. Well, now I think we'll go on to the Bridge of Chappaquiddick, because that is in the news. There's cartoons this week and everywhere about Ted Kennedy. Is he going to run? And what happened at Chappaquiddick. This was in 1969, July 1969, and everybody assumed that it was a very simple affair. He was caught with a girl, an accident happened, they had some drinks, at the end of it, maybe he shouldn't run if he behaves in this manner, and Ted Kennedy was put in his proper place, so-called, by the people that wanted to have him removed as an electoral candidate, I believe. The Chappaquiddick, what, don't you think that was the purpose of his dunking? I call it the dunking, just to get him out of the 72 elections?
Yes, to make it so that he would be, it would be very, nobody would want to have somebody for president who had been ostensibly been drinking and then carousing around with a girl, trying to go to the beach with her, and then he doesn't know how to handle himself and when he finally gets into an accident.
Then he lies about it besides.
And that came out later, right.
And doesn't report it, and who would want him for the president? That's the way the editorial
this is really, yeah, and this is really exactly what was planned, I think, and it came out very well. I think they did a very, very good job, whoever did it.
Yeah,
they being who?
Do you speculate? I have absolutely no idea.
Well, I speculate.
I have no idea. Let's put it that way.
I think that the way you speculate is you begin with the law enforcement agencies, that when you have a murder or a death, this particular girl was dead and for 10 hours, and all of her friends and buddies didn't discuss with each other, didn't come back and tell the group at the party she was dead, and the senator goes home and goes to sleep, gets up and has a healthy breakfast, and nobody knows anything is wrong. The way the information lined up, the chief of police to begin with in the area is responsible, and the doctor just says it's simple drowning. But at the same time, they quickly flew every witness out of town and never cross-examined them or did an autopsy. So I think the responsibility lies with the law enforcement agencies all the way up to the top. I know you don't agree with me at this part, Bob, but I think that when you want to find out how somebody was killed, you can find out, or you can ask a lot of questions and begin to want to know. But there's no desire to find out. And even when the judge had the inquest, the remark he made was, "I know you're all lying." What were his exact words to this? "You're lying through your teeth." He stepped Judge Boyle.
I don't really remember.
He made a remark that he was retiring at that point, but that he knew that everybody was lying through their teeth, that they weren't telling the truth at the inquest.
Well, certainly in the end of his statement, he certainly questioned the fact that whether Kennedy was really responsible for what he had said.
That's right. And people, when Kennedy was on the television program, I have many, many articles. I saved them all. And all over the country, they believe, well, this isn't the truth.
No.
So the law enforcement agency, you see, you can tell an untruth. Like you'd say, "Where were you last night?" And it was at Carnegie Hall or at Mary's apartment. That is a variable of truth. But when a person is dead and involved, you can't just take it as a flippant thing like, "Well, I guess we'll never know."
But what you have to do is look at it, let's say, for the way I was looking at it. Well, we were right, you know, I lived near the island.
Mm-hmm.
And when the news came out, most people realized it was just a simple accident, an automobile accident, and incidentally, there was a fatality connected with it. Now, there are accidents every day, and automobile accidents all happen all the time, and fatalities are connected with them. Now, unless you are trained or geared to looking for something, it doesn't become evident to you right then and there that there is foul play.
Well, I realize what
and
you're
this
saying.
This is the problem, I
the
think.
Weekend of that particular accident, Meyer Zelig was in my home, and we were talking, and he did 6 years of research on a book called Friendship and Fratricide on the framing of Alger Hiss by Whitaker Chambers.
Yeah.
And he's a psychiatrist in San Francisco, has a home in Carmel Valley. And, of course, he said to me, you know, very quite flippantly, "Oh, get off of it, May. It couldn't be a conspiracy. They were drinking. It was a girly party." I said, "You've spent 6 years seeking out planted evidence on Alger Hiss,
yeah,
and you take for granted that they wouldn't do it to Ted Kennedy." How
the thing
you
shouldn't take for granted is the fact that it's Kennedy. Well, this is the biggest single item.
But the whole thing is that two of Ted Kennedy's brothers have been murdered, and coming home from Alaska just shortly before this mishap, he said they were going to get him.
Right.
And Ted Kennedy, by all polls, even in 69, had made the decision that he would be the contender that Richard Nixon would have to face in 72.
It certainly seemed that this is exactly the time that he had made it, and that's when they stopped him, rather than kill him.
And so the best way to discredit him or put him aside and let him get the message, because you wouldn't want to kill the three Kennedys, would be to discredit, kill this particular girl and make it look like he was negligent.
Right.
And do you think, May, that, or Bob, that the plan to, if it was a plan to discredit the senator, relied upon his not being able to handle the situation, or would this plan have succeeded had the senator reported it right away, had been available right away, not had this haze over him, or was that part of the plan?
Yeah, we talked about it. We know that if he told, he would be killed. You know, we talked about this. Tell, you know, the book that you're doing, what your theory is about why he couldn't speak up.
Well, I think he's scared. I think it produced, again, the plan, whatever it was. And however they wanted to have it come out, the overall objective was to scare him and keep himself in the Senate, let's say. Okay, you can stay in the Senate, but the minute you jump out of the Senate and start running for the presidency, we will take care of you, the way we did with your two brothers. I mean, somebody must have put it in language that was abundantly clear. And whether he got the message directly or whether he got it indirectly, because he did not know anything about what had happened to him until 8 o'clock the next morning.
Oh,
I'm convinced of that.
Do you think he was driving the car?
No, he was not driving the car.
No, a book.
How can you say that? I mean, I want to see something behind that.
All right. If you'll let me just quote from Inquest, I think I can...
Inquest is an inquiry that took place in Massachusetts on this particular accident. There was really no cross-examination of any kind, was there? Each witness was spoke up. And,
right. There was no cross-examination. There's never been any cross-examination. No. Doesn't seem to have been any cross-examination in any of the investigations of the Kennedy murder.
Or autopsy. On the basis of my past research and reading, I had called Massachusetts and said, fingerprint the steering wheel. He was not driving the car. And this was from Carmel, California, and Bob Cutler's from Massachusetts. He believes Ted Kennedy was not driving the car because we have a lot of information would make us think that he was framed, that his car was pushed into the water, and that he was not in it at all.
Right.
And Bob Olson did a book called Bridget Chappaquiddick, where he says emphatically he was not driving the car. This is based upon a lot of things that are put together. In the first place, nobody ever saw Senator Kennedy wet, in wet clothing of any kind, wet hair, wet clothing. He went back to the cottage. He was supposed to have gotten help. His cousins were there. They didn't see him wet. He went back to the inn and to his room, changed his clothes. There was no discussion of wet clothing in his room or seeing him approach the inn. It was a small inn. The man who was there was awake at night. He came down and asked him the time. Were there eight rooms at that inn? You can read that PG testimony.
It was something like that.
Three upstairs, three down, and then...
Mr. Peachy didn't want to talk to me very much.
Mr. Peachy was at the desk. And
he was the innkeeper.
The
co-owner.
He was awake when the senator came down, and he didn't even recognize the senator. He didn't know who he was. But as far as driving the car, I had just finished reading a chapter on Otto John, the German who was very anti-Nazi and was in on a plan to kill Hitler. His family was all murdered because of this plan. He opposed Hitler. Can you find that chapter?
No, I can't find that, actually.
Yeah,
right,
but Otto John was the story of a man who came back to Germany to reconstruct Germany after the war, and he was opposed by Adenauer and by Reinhard Gehlen, General Reinhard Gehlen, who was chief of intelligence, reconstructing German intelligence with the CIA and Richard Helms, and they didn't appreciate Otto John disclosing who the former Nazis were. And he was warned when he left England, went back to Germany, they will get you, the Nazis will get you, because if you talk too much, and they will remember that you were anti-Nazi before the war, and they're restructuring the Nazis. And Otto John was warned, don't go back to Germany. But he was kidnapped and given some coffee and fell asleep, and he was taken to East Germany and then made totally discredited, went on the television, told the people in Germany that he was a communist. And the story, it's in The Secret War for Europe by James Hogan. It's a marvelous chapter. And I had just finished reading the discrediting of Otto John shortly before the Chappaquiddick affair, and I felt that Ted Kennedy and Otto John had common enemies, Reinhard Gehlen and Richard Helms of the CIA. Why did you think, going back
Well, I think, yes, going back to that simple question, I think the most telling part, there are two things that are very important in assessing whether or not he was driving. Number one, he said that as soon as he found out what had happened that morning, he immediately went to the police. Now, that happens to be the time is around 20 minutes past 9, and that's really, he found out at 8 o'clock.
See, when he found out what happened, he went to the police.
This is, I think, a very telling point. Now, this means something to me. The other assessment of why he was not driving the car comes about through the fact that that morning he was up around 7:15 or so, 7:30, and was out, went out, got a paper, got a little bit of breakfast, and met one of his friends against whom he'd been racing, went back up out of the porch outside his room in the hotel, was chatting, you know, sitting there talking to a couple of other friends, and Mrs. Richards also was there, and just talking about the weather, talking about the time, talking about the races, and the, you know, all these things, while actually you're supposed to now believe that at that precise moment he knew that he had been in an accident, that he had almost drowned, and that the reason there was a dead girl in his car was because he was negligent.
And he swam across the channel. How far was that?
Oh, 500 yards. I mean, it's not 500 yards. Nearer 500 feet, 100 yards, roughly. Something like that.
Oh, that's all, yeah.
He'd done all those things, but the main thing is that he was putting on all this front by talking about inconsequential trivia.
And nobody knew.
He knew there was a dead girl in his car that hadn't been found. And furthermore, he was waiting for something else to happen. Now, this is absolutely impossible for a man of his upbringing, for almost any human being, unless you've been trained in a really police state, to do this kind of thing, to act in a completely double capacity.
Well, also, besides the way he acted, and you say, well, was he trained or programmed, the way there's just the physical part of getting out of the car. He said, I don't know how I got out
car.
The doors were closed. Right. The windows in the front, were they open? I don't remember.
The window next to him was wide open.
Yep. But he said there was something about the doors that he thought he had opened a door, but he couldn't under the water pressure.
Right.
He has no way of knowing how he got out of that car.
And he never says.
No, and also, we'll go on to Mary Kopechnik next, who was in the car. But he didn't know how he got out, and his behavior was such that there was no indication of any way that he was aware of what happened until he went back to the island in the morning.
Right.
And the conversation, the effect, what do they say?
Well, Dargan and Markham came in and talked to him at 8 o'clock, and that's when he first found out what had happened to him.
And then he took
the
ferry.
And then they really had a bad time, because they've got to do something very quickly, because the more they delay, the more the, you know, leaving the scene of a crime, and it is a crime then, or leaving the scene of an accident. I mean, you can make it into a crime if you make it into manslaughter, which was not done. But the time element then became extremely important, and they must have had a very difficult time trying to figure out what to do.
How to account for those 10 hours that passed.
Right.
Well, I think that, again, backing the auto, John, I did a lot of research and read, you know, this information about the man who was with him, Mr. Crimmins, who served him a particular drink. I'm interested in how you take care of the food that evening or what was given to you, because Otto John's very, very close friend gave him a cup of coffee, and he became drowsy, and from then on, it was a whole trip to discredit his whole political career. He's in Germany now, but he can't have any office or do anything. Although he was renowned and prominent, a prominent conservative before the Hitler era, you know. And, you know, Mr. Kennedy was at the cottage, and he was given a rum and coke. In the inquest, they said, they asked Mr. Crimmins, who was his chauffeur, do you know whether Mr. Kennedy had anything to drink? And he said, I believe he had one drink when I saw him. And do you know what that was? Rum and Coca-Cola. How do you know this? Because I poured it for him at the time. Could you tell us what happened to the rum? He said, I poured some rum away from an open bottle. They drank some rum on Thursday night, and then this was Friday, and they poured some away. What is Kennedy's favorite drink? I'm not sure. Now, this is the man who served him for 9 years.
Oh, yeah.
And when they said to him, what is your profession? He said, legal aid and investigator. He was, Mr. Kennedy referred to him as a chauffeur, but he gave the judge the answer, I'm a legal aid and investigator. Could you tell us what he threw the rum away? Is he disposed to rum and coke? I think he might be.
Hmm.
then he says, in the summertime. Well, this was the summer, and he served him 9 years. Why wouldn't he know? And why was it all thrown away and not tested, you see, for what the contents was? He was tired and said he wanted to go home and sleep, and he said he'd take Miss Kopechne back, that she wasn't feeling well. Now, this is 11:15, and these people are pretty sophisticated, and they stay up a certain amount of hours. And there was this rumor under the title Gossip in Time magazine, we were talking about last night, that Mary Kopechne was drowsy at 11 and curled up in the back of a car. See, the unanswered questions, that we could go for, you know, many hours on those, make it necessary to open up the law enforcement proceedings on this particular case. Because there was a death, and we don't know whether he walked out with her, like he said, or whether she was drowsy.
There was no cross-examination. This is the real problem.
There was nothing.
There's nothing except what you can read in the printed word is the only thing we have now. That's the only record.
And then, again, you have the same problem that you have with the Warren Commission report or all these other, the assassination of Robert Kennedy, which has never been investigated. You have multiple witnesses that are involved who are never called. There's no court to question them.
Right.
The rundown of the people at the party, maybe we should just talk about those in a minute, because there were so many of them.
12.
Yeah, there were 12. And
12 people.
The important thing was that two of them were lawyers. They have prominent positions in Massachusetts.
Well, really three, if you count the senator.
Yeah, and the story is that they waited, that Ted Kennedy could say to two of the other lawyers, don't tell anyone in the party that Mary Kopechne's dead, and we'll do it in the morning. This is what was supposed to have happened.
This is also the printed record.
The printed record. You don't think it happened?
I know. I'm sure it didn't happen. I'm convinced that nobody said, let's not tell anybody else. They were told not to tell anybody else.
Yeah, Gargan and Markham.
Gargan and Markham were told not to tell anybody else, and they didn't.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, Markham never got back into the cottage until around 4:30, he says. Between 4 and 4:30, he said he'd been asleep in the Valiant, which was the other car.
The situation, for those who aren't familiar with it, was a little summer cottage. You've seen it.
Yes.
A little tiny cottage. Was it got two rooms?
Yes.
And there were...
I think it's two bedrooms, as a matter of fact.
And
a kitchen, living room.
Five girls and six gentlemen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you say...
Six and six. Everything was six and six.
Six and six.
Crimmins went to sleep. He was tired.
The chauffeur was tired and went
to sleep. He's a much older man. He's about 62 or 3.
Well, that's...
And he decided that he would just go to sleep. That's his testimony.
Yeah, and he let the others do their thing.
Right.
Do you want to describe these particular people? And
well, Crimmins was a chauffeur, and then LaRosa and Tretta were good friends. Or Ray LaRosa and Charlie Tretta were friends of the senator, and Gargan and Markham. Gargan's the senator's first cousin, and Markham is an old friend of his. I mean, they were there because of the political. It has been said that it was a political get together. In other words, all the girls had been in the campaigns, particularly with Robert Kennedy, and some of them with the president, and they all knew Teddy,
yeah.
And so this was a sort of get together, that's really all it was.
It was supposed to be just a loose thing. But by pairing them up, and Treader and Mary Keogh go off, and by pairing them and going
Cricket Keogh.
By splitting and going different directions, the suggestion is that it wasn't just a little political thing, so you have him in a compromising position right away.
Right away.
You have him if he goes there, and he says, well, I'll go meet all you other people and come home at 11, even if it's the most innocent kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
We constructed what we thought happened, and I think we should share it with the others, in the sense that when Senator Kennedy was examined for any accidents, his first statement was he was in a state of shock, but his doctor said he had a concussion. And my personal feeling is that he was hit on the head. How about you?
He had two hits. Two hits on the head.
Two hits on the head.
One behind his right mastoid, one on the top of his head.
Mm-hmm. Now, I feel that he could have left that house in the automobile, and somebody could be sitting behind and give him a concussion and then take him and dunk him if they have to, but I don't think they had to. He could have even been drowsy from something he was served and be taken right to the hotel and told what happened, or scared.
Or just knocked out
this
and
is the way,
held there.
According to all the evidence and the lack of testimony and the way it was handled, and the things that I put together, he was given a concussion and held there and told, you stay here.
Right.
And he was not told that his car was going to be thrown over a bridge with a particular girl in it dead.
Right.
No. And then in the morning, the men come back and say, your car's in the water.
Right.
And there's a body in it.
Right. And that's when they had a hard time figuring out what to do.
And how much to tell the wives and the press and the Senate and the president. And
I think Malcolm is responsible for deciding that the best thing that the senator could do was to plead guilty to a lesser charge and hope for the best that he'd get out of the others.
And leave
which is what happened.
Yeah. I feel that there's no way, if it was a conspiracy like the other murders that I talk about on this particular program, if this was a conspiracy to frame Ted Kennedy, you have to know the time and place and the milieu in which you can do it. And you have to be sure that the law enforcement people are going to prosecute or investigate. Because, you see, in Time magazine, we mentioned that last night, Mary Kopechne, there was a suggestion that she was drowsy and in the back of the car at 11 o'clock and that he didn't know she was in the back. All he had to do is get in the seat of his car and go back if the others are staying. If he sit on the head, he wouldn't even know, as we said before, that Mary's in there. But later, after it was well along its way and she was buried and the inquest was starting, it came out that she had blood on the black of her shirt. And where do you think this blood came from, that her garments were bloody after being... There was enough detected even after soaking in salt water 10 hours.
Let's get the answer to that after we break the station. You're listening to Dialogue Assassination on KLRB Carmel with Mae Brussel, the regular host of the program, the one who does the work every week. She's a research specialist here on the West Coast, and the guest today is Bob Cutler, who does similar work on the East Coast.